Steve Jones with us, The Serpent's Promise. Fascinating discussion about how science correlates with the Bible, maybe vice versa. How'd they ever do that? We're going to come back, continue talking with Steve Jones, and we'll take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Steve Jones with us. Steve, in the United Kingdom, this has been pretty controversial, this book, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, as I said to my publishers, I don't mind if the people who don't like it burn it, as long as they buy it first. And there's been elements of that.
What's causing, do you think, the uproar?
Well, I have to say, I was kind of surprised by it. Really, I mean, there's a pretty big difference in religiosity, if you want to call it that, on the opposite sides of the Atlantic. The U.S. in general, as you possibly know, is a much more religious society than most European societies, certainly British society is. So I haven't had much flack from believers in the literal truth of the Bible, 4004 B.C., and dinosaurs and the ark and that kind of stuff. Okay, but I've had a lot of complaints, and many of the reviews are actually quite vicious, that saying I shouldn't have done this, from people who are themselves believers. What was the one that we put one quote on the back of the British paperback? Where is it here? This is Steve Jones once again re-cranks the Darwinist battle organ, accompanied by the monkey of new atheism as it screeches petulantly at religion. Well, I thought that's good. But the reason they don't like it, and I really was quite startled by this, was that they don't like the idea, as we mentioned briefly in the first part of the program, they don't like the idea that any of the events in the New Testament or the Old Testament had a literal meaning.
No.
In terms of the great flood, in terms of disease, in terms of hallucinations and visions, many of which have been interpreted in psychiatric terms. They just don't like that idea. And I honestly don't understand why they don't like that idea. But that's where we fall out with them. And, of course, I've also had quite a lot of feedback from the U.S. that says you're completely wrong because the Earth isn't, the universe isn't 14 billion years old. It's 6,000 years old.
Yeah, you have a lot of creationists who believe that.
You do, yes, which to me is odd. It seems to me, they're free to believe what they want to believe, but it seems to me that flying in the face of the obvious facts like that is doing much more harm to religion than it is to science. I mean, if you imagine a 10-year-old boy or girl being told that the Earth is 6,000 years old, say, and then going to high school and discovering from his science or her science lessons that it's not, that isn't going to do their belief in religion any good at all.
No.
Either they reject the truths of science, which is very hard to do in the modern world, or you realize that the people who are religious have been telling you untruths. Now, that seems to me much more of a worry for religion than it is for science.
You have said that there is a science of religion.
Yes. It's a softish science because it's anthropology. It's studying humans. It's studying human behavior. Okay, but there is, in many senses, I mean, you can take particular events in the Bible, particularly a lot of the sort of hallucinatory events, the visions that people had, and some of them are really almost precise descriptions of particular well-known, either serious or mild, mental disorders. There's one great one, which again I dug out when I was doing the book. There is a famous saint called Hildegard of Bingen, a female saint who lived, I think, the 13th or 12th centuries. And she was actually a wonderful musician. She wrote some wonderful church music. And she's, of course, deeply religious. And she had a book in which she illustrated the vision. She had visions, and she illustrates these visions. And they are, she says, like battlements around the city of God. You have a bright spot, the city of God, which is turning, and it's got battlements around it. Well, that's a migraine, okay? That's what we call a scotoma. And I get scotomas occasionally, many people do. And you suddenly see this thing in your visual field, which blocks out something. You can't see it. It turns around. And it would be natural to say that you're having a vision of God, but you're not. There's some little explosion taking place in your brain. Now, it's foolish to say that all faith is like that. That's not true. But you can ask, what can science tell us about religious societies? What why are some places religious and some places not? How do they get going? Well, it's kind of obvious, really. I mean, there are some very obvious things. I mean, religion, first of all, has got a strong genetic component, which seems a strange thing to say, except that if you look across all faiths, whichever one you like, Christianity as much as you like, without exception, women are more religious than men are. And women are women because they're genetically different from men.
Interesting.
So it's a bit foolish to say that the gene for atheism is on the Y chromosome, but it's an observation you can make. It's also the case that you can interview people and ask them questions about their beliefs, and religion is heritable. The willingness to believe can be inherited, and there may be genes behind it. We don't know. But these are the kinds of things you can ask when you're asking a science about a science of religion, and there's a lot of it, really.
All right, let's take some calls here for you. Let's pick it up by going to Richard in Dallas, Texas, to get things going. Richard, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure.
Very interesting discussion, as always. My favorite radio show, Coast
Thank
to Coast.
Thank you so much.
Okay. I take a different view. I don't think God has two eyes, two ears, two legs, and two arms. I do believe in the Big Bang, and I believe that at one point the entire universe was a black hole formed as a singularity, as Mr. Hawking, the physicist, says. But here's where I differ from science.
Okay.
There is a consciousness before the Big Bang. It's kind of like an exhale at infinity, and there will be an inhale as the black hole collapses again, as we collapse again into the infinite black hole. With all of that being said, let me think a moment how I can explain my vision of how man comes about. Man, as far as I'm concerned, is God necessarily having to project himself down to these little fish in the old oceans in order to explore himself and look up eventually to see the stars and to travel them. And I believe in a multiverse in which all of us are fallen like Humpty Dumpty off the Great Wall. But all the pieces are put together again by this infinite consciousness that has no form, no arms, no legs, no ears, and all the rest of it. And I will also say this without any doubt whatsoever, George, in my own mind, that there are two versions of God and two versions of creation in the Bible. Genesis 1 contradicts Genesis 2, and there's only one that's true. The God of the Bible, and I'm Jewish, so don't call me anti-Semitic, that called for the death of women and children after battles had already been won, mm-hmm. is a two-armed, two-legged angel that had, or maybe even a man, that had great power over people through force and intimidation. The other God appears as love through Jesus Christ, and by the way, that's the God I follow in love. And in him there is no hatred, and there is no animosity, and he loved his enemies and blessed those who persecuted him, to the point where he said, while they were stripping his flesh, Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. So I'm saying the Bible is contradictory because it has two different authors. Now, one can speculate as to who those authors are, but let's call them two thought forms. One that wants to control man by force, punishment, and reward.
And fear.
And the other who loves unconditionally and even gave his life that we may be saved.
Let's get you to react to that, Steve. I would.
Yeah. I mean, the trouble is in terms of, asking what was before the Big Bang. It's like asking what's north of the North Pole, okay? It's not a question that makes any sense. Now, I'm no mathematician.
And there's no answer.
I'm baffled. There's no answer, okay? Now, if you want to say God did it, fine, but there's no way of testing whether that's true. I think Richard makes an interesting point of the difference between the New Testament and the Old Testament. Now, if you look at my own trivial book, most of it, nearly all of it, apart from the last chapter, is about the Old Testament, and the Old Testament is a thrilling history, telling you some really interesting and partly correct stories about history, and full of good anecdotes and really good fun to read. But it looks back. The New Testament is totally different. It's a much more stimulating book, really, because it looks forward. It says, you should live in this way. And it asks the question, which we can't answer. It's what I sometimes think of as the unto others question. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Okay. Now, to a biologist in the animal world, say, that makes no sense. You should only be nice to another animal if it's going to be more nice back to you. You know, look after your children or something like that. You certainly shouldn't be altruistic unless you've got hidden selfishness there. But the New Testament is all about that. And it's all about saying, you know, you should be, it's about rights for women, it's about honoring parents, it's about, you know, rich men not going through, not getting to heaven except through the eye of the needle, getting rid of their wealth. All these really very modern ideas. In fact, I think it was Thomas Jefferson who produced a version of the New Testament where he took out all the miracles and the resurrection and so on and just left the narrative of what Jesus said about the way in which you ought to live. And he said that this was the basis for a perfect society. And in many ways, I would have to say I agree with him. There's no question of that. And that's what my last chapter is about. Does religion make societies better or worse? Is religion necessary for society to persist? As Richard said, is there, as it were, a better angel of our natures? And I think, again, that's Lincoln, I think, which makes us behave better than mere animals. I think there is. Now, I don't actually believe that you need a God to explain that, but it's an interesting question. Why is there such a thing? And we don't know the answer.
Would you be surprised, Steve, if one day the facts came out that there is a divine creator?
It would surprise me, but if it was provable, and I'm not clear how it could be, I would accept it. And that really is a statement of the difference between faith and science, because scientists reluctantly, perhaps, are always willing to change their minds. They have to accept that they could be wrong. And
right.
For many people of faith, they simply can't accept that. There's a famous example of that, which was in 1904, the president of the British Royal Society, which is the equivalent of the National Academy of Sciences in the US, gave a talk about the future of physics. And he said to the physicists of the world, stop doing physics. It's all finished. It's done. It's boring. We understand how it all works. Do something more interesting, okay? 1905, relativity, Einstein. The whole of physics fell apart. And we had to go more or less back to the beginning and start again. Now, people hated that. You know, their entire careers were ruined. They had to learn a new kind of physics. But in the end, a lot of groaning and moaning, they accepted it. I don't think that would ever happen with a religion.
Probably not. It is amazing, I think, as you look at the correlations in religion and science. Now, we've talked primarily tonight about the Old Testament. What about the New Testament and all this verbiage of a person named Jesus and all the incredible things that he apparently did?
Yeah, I got a pained letter from somebody, and I did feel slightly guilty about it. And this letter said about my book, Jesus isn't even in the index. Okay, and I thought, oh dear, that was a mistake. But the problem was, I decided, I think perhaps wrongly, that there was nothing to be gained in trying to explain, as so many people have, the miracles of Jesus, say, that's walking on the water,
raising Lazarus from the dead.
Raising of Lazarus. Now you could explain those things. You could say, for example, you could say Lazarus, perhaps he was in shock. And he came back out of his coma. You could say that. Or the walking on the water. There's a long argument that the word on in Aramaic, the language of the Bible, is the same as the word by. So he's walking by the water. So you can have these kinds of arguments, but to me they're unrepaying because they're arguments about details. The answer is people can't walk on the water. People cannot come back from the dead. So I don't think that science comes into it. But they are these statements of myths and parables. They're myths and parables about having to believe the unbelievable. And perhaps the most unbelievable thing of all was that you have to be nice to people. Okay? Now, that would have been an idea totally alien to the Israelites. If you go as your previous caller said. If you go back to the early chapters of the Old Testament, the slaughter, death, murder, the terrible events that are going on today, we can see them repeating them again on both sides. It's primitive, it's hellish. Okay, the New Testament is not like that. It's a much, much more profound document. And if we could live according to its precepts, I think we'd live in a much happier world. But unfortunately, if you look at the history of Christianity, as of every other religion, you find again and again the people flying in its face in terms of the wars of religion in Europe in the late Middle Ages, the early modern period. And again, there's a bit of science in there. If you look at wars, and there's a science of wars, wars which are sparked off by religion, as we see, for example, in the Middle East between the two, between the Sunni and the Shia, shall we say, tend to last much longer than wars that are based on economics, things like the First and Second World War. And that sort of tells us that somehow our urge to believe is being spoiled by the fact that we think our belief is better than your belief, and we have to kill you because you don't share our belief. And that's the other side of religion. It's a wonderful theory, but in practice, it's perhaps not so good.
Let's go to Travis in Dayton, Ohio. Travis, go ahead with your question.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering why it's been said that the only true science is chemistry, and that would mean that all other science is a type of religion. Science has told us that the Earth was flat hundreds of years ago. Science is what told us that planets revolved around Earth, that the sun revolved around the Earth. I was just wondering why, with science having a history of being wrong, proven wrong time and time again, and I would imagine in another couple hundred years that the science that we believe today will also be proven wrong. Why would we believe science instead of a religious book that has never been proven wrong in 2,000 years? And that's my question.
Okay. Fair enough.
I think you're right. I mean, that's the essential point about science. A lot of the stuff which is in my book, I hope, is wrong, because that's the way science makes progress. By proving, demonstrating that what you've got, what you believe today, in fact, isn't right. You need a better theory. Somebody once said that, again, this was a president of the Royal Society in Britain, he said, there is only physics. Everything else is stamp collecting. And, I can see that. There are fundamental sciences. Perhaps the most fundamental of all is mathematics. And everything else is details. And what I do as a scientist, as a very mediocre scientist, is I fiddle around with the details. And if the details I fiddle around with are wrong, they're going to have to change. Now, I honestly can't agree with you that nothing in the Bible has ever been proved wrong, unless in the general sense it's very difficult to prove a negative. It's clearly the case that many of the literal beliefs of the Bible, the age of the earth, let's say, even the resurrection, are certainly the age of the earth, are wrong. There's no question of that. But does that matter? The Bible is much more profound than arguing about dates. So I think faith and science are different, but as many people have said, that's not original to me, that they can live together. But they get into trouble, both of them, when they start attacking each other on their own grounds and not taking into account the views of the opposing party.
There's got to be, Steve, don't you think, some middle ground there, obviously.
I think there is a middle ground, and I'm not on the middle ground. I'm an atheist, okay. But there are many, many scientists, far better scientists than I am, who are profound believers. Many of the people in the history of science, even Galileo, was a believer in a sense that we find hard to understand. Newton, the same. We can't understand the depths of their belief. And many of them rationalize their science as an attempt to understand the workings of God's mind. I mean, Newton himself said he was interested much more in God's words, the Bible, rather than God's works, the universe.
Steve, we're going to take this final break, and then we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, first hour, we're going to talk about this incredible water situation in Toledo, Ohio. At least 400,000 people can't use their tap water because of some algae that is in the water system. And can that get, out there into other places? And then we'll be talking to John Hoag about his prophecies. When we come back in a moment with Steve Jones, We'll take your final phone calls as we talk about the Serpent's Promise. Welcome back, Steve Jones with us. Steve, you tried to rewrite Charles Darwin's The Origin of Species. Tell me why and what was the end result?
Well, it's an interesting experience. I mean, I frequently warn my students, as all professors do, of the dangers of plagiarism, you know, stealing somebody else's work and presenting it as your own. But I have my fingers crossed because I'm kind of a serial plagiarist in this Bible book, of course, steals the structure of the Bible. But the Darwin book was remarkable. I'm, by profession, I'm an evolutionary biologist. As I often say, I'm one of the world's top six experts on the genetics of snails, and the other five agree. Okay, it's a pretty narrow field.
Yeah.
But evolution is a fascinating science because really, you can almost point the moment at which the modern evolution began, which is 1859, November the 4th, I think it was, which is when The Origin of Species by Charles Darwin was published. And he wrote it in a great hurry because he was pushed into it by getting a letter from somebody with the same idea. And he calls it one long argument, and it starts off with something everybody knows about, and animals and plants change on farms, and it ends up in the last chapter with the unthinkable thought in those days that that's the way that humans came into being. And on the way, it talks about fossils, it talks about animals and plants on islands, it talks about great floods, it talks about behavior. And what I basically did was to take the structure of that book and tear off all the facts and leave, as it were, the steel frame of the building behind and bolt on the scientific facts of today. So that if Darwin was writing today, what examples would he put in? And I was astonished, and I have to say I was astounded, really, by how well his argument fits together when you put in not the facts of 1859, but the facts of the year 2000, which is about when I wrote it.
Well, wasn't he a believer in God, though, Steve? Darwin?
He certainly started off as a believer in God. There's no question.
Yeah.
Because, like most people of those days, he actually studied theology at university. He wanted to be a vicar, but that was the path that was laid out for him. But in the end, it's pretty clear that he lost his faith. He didn't make a fuss about it. He didn't turn into Richard Dawkins and bang his chest about having lost his faith. But it is a myth, and it is a myth, and it's not true, that on his deathbed he repented. But that only turns on the word of one woman who visited him, and she was a Christian proselytizer, and she claimed that he'd repented, but only to her. But it doesn't matter. The fact that he was not a believer doesn't alter the beauty of his science. It's just the same way as the fact that Newton was a believer altered the beauty of his science. They don't matter. But I can tell you, it was in many ways actually a rather emotional thing for me to rewrite that book, because I hadn't realized what a good book it was until I tried to do it.
Okay, let's go to our final calls here for you now. We shall go to Rob in Las Vegas, Nevada to get things going. Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Science has done a pretty good job of keeping us well informed, but some people believe that the things that science discovers and passes on to us is merely explaining to us how God does things. And they've studied the Shroud of Turin to death, if you will, and even many of the archaeologists that I've read about have studied that shroud since its discovery are themselves dying off, and they have, at least a couple of the prominent ones, have concluded that where the Shroud of Turin, and they've concluded that there just really is no test for Christness. And I would say that, it's also said that God may have given us time in itself merely for the fact that everything doesn't all happen at once to us. And my final comment and question to your guest tonight, George, is what he knows or what he might be able to tell us about this huge revival that took place in Wales in the very early 1900s with a man named Evan Roberts.
Okay, let's see if you can address that. Thanks, Rob. I appreciate it. Go ahead.
Well, I can. I mean, that actually comes very close to my own experience. The Shroud of Turin thing is I think most people would agree that actually that's a medieval relic from about 1300. But that's, many of these relics, I think most believers see them as metaphors rather than the real thing. The Welsh Revival is an amazing thing. It started with this guy, the Roberts, as you said, and it started very strangely, but it's true, in the little village where I was brought up, and its English name is New Quay, on the west coast of Wales. And it started in the very chapel, the tabernacle, where my grandparents, who were very, very religious, used to go every Sunday, often and during the week as well. And like many religious revivals, in fact, it was a very progressive social movement, because Wales in those days, and I have to say it's come back to it now, and New Quay, which is a little tiny fishing village which also built sailing ships. I forgot how many pubs there were in New Quay. There was something, probably 1,000 people there and 50 pubs, 50 bars. And drink was a major, major problem. And this revival spread Methodism, Welsh Methodism, across Wales. It was strongly temperance-led, that drink was a bad thing, and although I do drink, I agree that drink is a bad thing. And it had an enormous success. It generated a society which was still extant when I was a young boy in the 1950s, bound together by going to the chapel, by singing, by speaking Welsh, and it was a very, very attractive society in many ways. But like many revivals, that's why they're called revivals, it didn't last. Whether we need another one is an interesting question. And I'm very impressed that an American knows about that revival, because its shadow is still very strong in Wales.
Yeah, our listeners are unbelievable, Steve, let me tell you. They study, they probe. Let's go to Will in Plainfield, Indiana now. Hey, Will, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, big fan of both you guys.
Thank you, sir.
I was just wondering, what is Steve's take on oracles, and not just in the Bible, like modern day, like Edgar Cayce? I'll take my answer off there. Thanks.
Okay.
Sorry, I didn't quite pick that.
What are your thoughts on oracles? You know, those prognosticators.
Soothsayers. Yeah, sure. They've always been there. Now there are many. There was the famous Delphic oracle who studied in Delphi in ancient Greece, and made predictions about the future, some of which came true, no question of it. Interesting scientific fact, if you go to where she sat in her labyrinth, actually that was on the top of a little volcanic vent, and all kinds of strange gases used to get into the labyrinth, and she probably hallucinating a lot by breathing this stuff in. Now, there have been lots of oracles, and there are people like the Seventh-day Adventists who believe that the world was going to come to the end on whatever it was, I think it was 1882, on a particular date. And that date appeared, and the world didn't come to an end, but they just put it off for a couple of centuries. So the trouble with oracles, and we have them today, is that you always remember the ones that get it right. You forget the ones that get it wrong. And on average, I think they get it right at about the same rate as you would by flipping a penny. So unless an oracle is making a prediction based on some kind of fact, on economics, let's say, although that's only barely fact, I have to agree, a lot of it's religion more than science, I don't really take them very seriously. I mean, I think it's good to speculate about the future, but not unless you've got some evidence which isn't just a belief that something is bound to happen.
Good point. John is in North Dakota now, and it's his turn. Go ahead, John.
Hello there.
Hi, John.
Yes, hi. I'd like to disagree with your host.
Don't disagree with me. Disagree with the guest.
excuse me.
That's all right. Go ahead.
I believe, first of all, I let's lead you to Matthew 24. Luke 21.
Yeah, sure.
And Revelations chapter 9. And I think I think we're at the time of the end.
Well, we may be. Now, what do you think about Revelation, Steve? Something that could occur, but hasn't yet.
Well, That's true. And Revelation is, you know, a hallucinatory book. There's no question of it. Okay. And Newton, who we've mentioned, was fascinated by Revelation. He wrote thousands of words about the beast, you know, the, how many horns would the beast have and that kind of stuff. And Revelation is an odd book. It's one of the books that only just made it into the Bible. There's lots and lots of books which didn't make it into the standard versions of the Bible. And it was the Revelation of St. John on the island of Patmos. And he has these visions of apocalyptic horrors and great beasts coming from with teeth and that kind of stuff. And it's really hallucinatory stuff, you know. I don't know what he was on, but he's on something pretty powerful. Now, in some senses, again, and I don't deal with this in my own book, but if you stand back from that and you say, okay, what's going to happen to the world? What's going to happen to us? The answer is absolutely clear. It's going to come to an end. Now, there are two visions of revelations of astronomers, one of which is we'll burn to death, and the other of which will freeze to death. And I think in the short term, when the sun expands, as it's already doing, the Earth will be consumed in a fiery furnace, a little bit like John Patmos' revelations, okay. But in the long term, when the whole brief episode of the universe from the Big Bang onwards goes back to being cold and calm and nothing happening, we'll freeze to death. So take your choice, burn or freeze. There's nothing I can do about it.
Let's go to Don in Honolulu in Hawaii, first-time caller. Don, go ahead.
Yes, sir. Nice to talk to you. I want to let you know something. You know that science does come into play, especially in Genesis, and this is where it comes into play is, you know, when it said that God took Adam's rib and made Eve, do you know what the rib was? It was DNA.
Well, you can say that. It doesn't say that God took Adam's DNA. You can say that. I've never actually heard that particular explanation, but you can say that.
Well, it is. Can I explain something else to you? It is evolutionary creationism. God made evolution to create things. That's what it is. And, you know, and it goes all up and down in Proverbs, too. How did he know that the ants are females? He taught this to, who is it, Solomon?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
you understand?
People have said, first of all, I don't want to criticize the details of the Adam and Eve story, but it's clearly the case that it would be impossible for the first creatures to be male, because they can't reproduce. The first creatures must have been female in the sense that they could reproduce. Males came along later as kind of parasites on females, so that the story should have been that God created Adam from Eve's rib, if anything. But I think that's, you know, it's a metaphor. The argument that God made evolution happen is a widespread argument. And the trouble is, to me, is I wouldn't know how to test whether that's true or not. How would you know? I mean, I don't think science can tell you that. If you wish to believe that God made evolution happen, I think that's just fine. But there's no way I can test it. There's no way you can test it. So I think we're each of us allowed to hold to our own particular belief.
Did you expect the serpent's promise to be so controversial, Steve?
No, I didn't really. I mean, I did. I made an effort. I really made an effort, and I think I was going to do so, not to be insulting about religion. Okay.
I understand.
This is not a book. You know, this isn't a burn this book. It's an honest attempt to do this eccentric thing, which I'm amazed has never been done before, which is to use modern eyesight to ask ancient questions. But it's caused more of a fuss than I would have liked. On the other hand, it is selling lots of copies, so I can't complain.
Let's go to Fernando in Miami. Hi, Fernando. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello. Good evening and good morning, Mr. Norris.
You too.
Hello to your distinguished guests and your distinguished listeners from coast to coast. I think that we all need something to believe in, because it's very difficult to live in a vacuum without knowing where we come from, where we're going to, who created everything, etc. In in the past, you know, the Europeans have their own gods, the Greek gods and the Roman gods, you know, like Zeus, the king god of the Greeks. Mm-hmm. But they have so many gods that it made it difficult to be a believer. You know, like the Romans have Ceres, the god of cereal or agriculture. They got Neptune, the god of the seas, and this made it very difficult to have so much specialty gods. So the Jewish folks who wrote the Bible made everything very simple by having just one God, sort of like the Walmart of gods, you know, consolidate all the different gods into one store, and they call it an almighty God. And then they gave it a face, so it would be very easy to identify it and address it. That face is Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus Christ. And the Catholics made it even more easier by having all these saints and virgins and angels, etc.
Okay, let's get a quick reaction as we wrap things up, Steve. We've only got a minute to go. And bottom line is, one, I think we both agree, something over a series of years and thousands of years, something dramatic happened on this planet. You agree?
Oh, absolutely, yes, of course. I have to say, the funniest thing I've heard in this program, and the funniest thing I've heard for a long time, was your previous description of Christianity as the Walmart of gods. That's wonderful. I'll use that myself.
You can use that on your next one. Hey, Steve, I want to thank you for being on the program. Good luck with your next work, too, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Steve Bye-bye. Jones, live in the United Kingdom. I know his phone was a little muddy, but I wanted to continue on with that interview, so I hope you understand. On our next Coast to Coast program, I do want to talk about that situation in Toledo, Ohio, because it could happen elsewhere. Algae in the city drinking water, they can't use the water. How long? Who knows? What a disaster. Followed by, of course, John Hogue and his prophecies. For Nathan Staton, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lodehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.